Hello everyone and welcome to another Press Start podcast. I'm your host as always, Stuart Lang. If you want to hit me up on Twitter if you disagree with anything I say or want to talk shit about something, out after dark 216 if you want to get me on Twitter. I apologise for missing last week. I was in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, which is famous for having basically everything legalized over there, so it was 2 days where I was in no fit state to talk on a recorded podcast. So I am back, I am prepared, kind of, and I have a guest who is not quite so prepared. He's out running errands, but he's been quite happy to jump in. He's someone that you guys will all know and love already, just as much as the rest of us do, and that is the one and only Mr. Sean Comer. Sean, how are you doing this fine Friday evening?
Oh, I'm doing just great. Like I said, I'm out in my car right now. I'm driving around Phoenix on a gorgeous, frankly, it's nice weather, but kind of cloudy day. And Stu happened to say, "Hap, I need co-host." And I said, "Okay, I can co-host." And so, yeah, I don't know where I'll be going or what I'll be doing during this podcast, but yeah, just kind of forgive and forget whatever you might happen to hear in the background.
Yeah, we're on a magical mystery tour of Phoenix, but I'm pretty sure that everyone can agree, if you were able to listen through the podcast I recorded on my own a few weeks ago, that I am definitely better with someone to bounce back and forward with, because me on my own is just, it's a rabbit in headlights situation. And if you made it through that show, and even if you remotely enjoyed it, then I praise you. I quite frankly don't know how you were able to do it. But what we're going to talk about today is something that is kind of stuck in my craw a little bit the last few days. Just to set the scene a little bit, I finished Mass Effect Andromeda this afternoon, and I feel like that game has had such a hard time from press, from social media. Is it perfect? No, it isn't. But do you know what? It's more Mass Effect, and I don't see what people are so upset about. We knew Commander Shepard wasn't going to come back. We knew we were going to get a new environment. We knew we were going to get new pro and antagonists. And do you know what? Quit your fucking bitching, people. Like, there is nothing fundamentally wrong with this game. Yes, there are points where I've cringed at the dialogue, and yes, there are points that I've literally burst out laughing at some of the animations, but maybe it's the Bethesda fan in me. This game is not that bad. And without talking about that, because I know that despite the fact that anyone who knows Sean at all will know that he's a massive Mass Effect fan, real life situations means he's not been able to get a next gen console to play it yet. So we're not going to talk about Andromeda. I don't want to talk about Andromeda any more than that. But I wanted to bring the power of positivity into this, because I feel like I am driving the power of positivity for Andromeda and defending it where I can. So we're going to talk about what we think are you know, perfect games. And because, Sean, you're such a Mass Effect fan, it makes perfect sense to kind of start there. You and I both have huge respect and love for the Mass Effect franchise, certainly thus far. I still do. I can't wait until Andromeda 2 or whatever the hell they're going to call the next part in this series. But I'm all in. If I was able to pre-order it now, I'd pre-order it now. I'm quite happy to continue Stuart Ryder's adventures through the Andromeda Galaxy, despite whatever problems there may have been. Because, do you know what? It was just a damn fun game. And that's what people are forgetting now, I think, more than ever. Like, games are meant to be fun. You know, they can't all be perfect. Because, you know what? Suck it up, people. Life isn't perfect. You know? You go for a drive, something happens to annoy you, do you then suddenly you never want to drive anymore? No, of course you don't. So we're going to talk about some things that we really enjoy, and yeah, we'll just talk about the Mass Effect trilogy very briefly without wanting to get into Andromeda and spoil anything for Sean, because he's not been able to get into it yet. But yeah, Sean, What is it that sort of resonates with Mass Effect so much with you? Like, if you want to talk about that for a sec.
Well, first off, let me just finish up washing my hands here. But thank you, first of all, for kind of remaining spoiler-free as possible for me. I'm still very much aware of the problems that Andromeda has had since launch. And yeah, I mean, you're right. Mass Effect is, that's my holy grail of video game franchises. But just to put this right out there and acknowledge it up front, no bones about it, it's never been a perfect franchise.
Thank you.
There has never been a perfect game in it.
No.
To date, no matter what anybody will say. It's no secret that Mass Effect 2 is my single, number one, class by itself, favorite game of all time. Not just because of how much I enjoyed it, but also because I'm biased, because I have a very strong personal attachment. I have a very close personal relationship with somebody that's very much kind of inextricably tied to her having introduced me to that game.
Yeah.
And the fact that I've just fallen in love with it completely independently over the years as a deeper result. But is it perfect? No, not at all. It has one of the finest, deepest, longest stories of any video game that I've ever played. Yes, that's very true. Is there absolute tons to do in that game? Yes. Is it the best example of the idea that your choices matter in terms of the outcome and what carries forward in the Mass Effect 3? Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. Absolutely. It's at times dark, funny, beautiful, personal. It's heartbreaking. It's thrilling. It has an incredible score, amazing voice acting top to bottom. Some characters that you become so immersed in. So, I had to ignore a call there for a second. So very, very easily. So much so that even when you encounter them time and again on repeat playthroughs, it still evokes the same emotion year after year after year. It's absolutely incredible in that regard.
Yeah.
But that being said, in terms of is it absolutely flawless? No. Quite frankly, the run and gun combat has always been utterly terrible. There are a number of characters that I feel are drastically kind of either underpowered or underutilized, or that I would have even rather have seen have just a bigger role from start to finish. Hang on one second. Yes, that's all.
We did say it was a magical mystery tour. We did say at the top of the show that we were expecting extra characters in this podcast.
Yes. And today's show is brought to you by your friendly Tempe, Arizona Quick Trip and Diet Dr. Pepper. specifically a Big Q Fountain Diet Dr. Pepper with very little ice and cherry and vanilla flavoring. Anyway. there are characters that I feel are badly underutilized. They really stripped away a lot of the RPG customization elements to make it much more of a shooter. And as a result, I felt that a lot was lost in terms of being able to play some of the classes the way you would have really wanted to. But by that same token, does any of that really take away from how much I love the game? No, absolutely not. And that's the thing about video games. As a medium, they really have a lot more important moving parts in place than any other form of entertainment. When you think about music and how you can assess an album or a song, you can think about its lyrics, its composition, its production, but you run out of things pretty fast that you can really judge it based on. When it comes to television or movies, you look at how was it written, how was it acted, How does it look? How was the plot? And maybe there are some other genre-specific elements you can take into consideration there. With video games, you have so much that you that any studio, any developer, any publisher has to balance all at once. You've got graphics. You've got length. You've got depth of gameplay. You've got difficulty. Downloadable content. How many endings are there? The control scheme. If we're to throw PC games in there, fuck it. Just ratchet it up about another possible 1,000 points of critique. And you are never going to make absolutely everybody happy. I'm sorry if I kind of got off track from the actual question there. I was kind of multitasking for a little bit.
No, it's okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, if you look at the first four Mass Effect games, the first game was an excellent game that definitely had some flaws and some imperfections to kind of grind off for the second one. The second game I felt addressed virtually all of them. There's nothing that BioWare didn't give their all and leave it all on the floor to improve in some measure. Mass Effect 3, okay, it's let's just be frank here. It's the best of the first two games rolled into one.
Yeah.
Full stop. You have quite easily something that ranks far above Mass Effect in terms of aesthetic appeal, but still comes in, I think, just a little bit below Mass Effect 2 in a lot of regards. It easily controls the best of both games, aside from the fact that I will one day kick Square in the daddy bag, whoever it is that decided that the dodge, roll, and snap to cover buttons should be mapped to the same input.
Yeah.
Just fuck you running for every single time you have ever killed me at the worst possible moment, you asswipe. I hold you directly responsible for so many deaths. The ending, you know what, it is what it is, but I never felt remotely as salty about it as a lot of people did. And I was frankly shocked at just how far the extended cut went to still try and make everybody happy, despite that often revealing the very worst of how gamers can act.
Yeah. I mean, do you know what? It's actually funny because on my time hop, maybe 2 weeks ago, I think, a status popped up that was defending the end of Mass Effect 3. Like, it was, I had completed it, I was a little bit behind everyone else, and I defended it. Because, do you know what? Like, all things have to end. And, do you know, I was actually one of the few people who really couldn't fault the real, or sort of the original ending of it. Like, would I have liked my choices to have maybe meant a little bit more? Okay. Sue me. But realistically, having played Andromeda now for probably around 30 hours worth of gameplay, Andromeda is only a bad game if you really compare it to the original trilogy as it being a fourth. This is a better game than Mass Effect 1, in my opinion. I would probably say that I've had as much fun with Andromeda as I did Mass Effect 3. Two is a tough comparison, because two, I think, is the absolute perfect combination of everything, like you said, quite perfectly. Like, two just rolls so much in, and yeah, it's a shame that people are going to be looking at this and sort of saying, well, it's not as good as Mass Effect 3, it's not as good as Mass Effect 2. Well, no, it isn't, but also, if you go back and look at Mass Effect 1, like, I've not played Mass Effect, in terms of the first trilogy, more than twice, but the second time I played through them, I really struggled with the first one. I really struggled with not being able to do certain things and having to compensate for the game not being where I was with the series. And considering the amount of changes and bugs and issues that this game's actually had, do you know what? People are just being butthurt for the sake of it at this point, I think. Like, this, if this trilogy continues, which it is meant to, and that's great, because, like I said before, I'm all in on a sequel. If this is the Mass Effect 1 to a classic trilogy, then this is actually a pretty good opener. This is a really good opener. And quite honestly, if I had enjoyed the first Mass Effect as much as I've enjoyed Andromeda, then who knows? Like, I think it'd probably be up there in conversation as genuinely my favourite games of all time, or my favourite trilogies, certainly. But that's kind of where I want to go with this podcast. I want to talk about other game series. I want to talk about other things that we deem as perfect. And one that I know we've spoken about before, Sean, that I want to mention is BioShock.
Oh yeah.
And people who know me quite well will have no problem in understanding my love for BioShock. I will put it out there. I don't know if we're going to get the chance to even touch upon it on this show, but I would probably say that Fallout is my favourite game. Fallout 3, New Vegas are probably my favourite games of all time. But the BioShock trilogy is my favourite game series of all time. And like I say, we've spoken about it before, but what can you say about the BioShock games that hasn't been said already by someone or you know anyone on any other podcast on any other medium? They're perfect. The interlinking stories and the amount of such beautiful juxtaposition between the games, especially Infinite, which takes you out of Rapture for the majority of it. Like, there's just so little to criticize here.
It's those games are everything that I would point to in terms of trying to get across to somebody just how far gaming has evolved since the days of Donkey Kong and Mario Brothers and Pac-Man in terms of pure storytelling. And in fact, a lot of times, narrative that far exceeds the vast majority of what Hollywood or television or even the literary world has put forth over the past kind of parallel decade that those industries have experienced. If you're looking at the first game, it's, well, first off, it is fantastically atmospheric.
Yeah.
It is, you know, everything you're seeing nowadays that has led to a revival of the horror genre in video games, BioShock was doing it a console generation ago and really laying the foundation for it. And even then, we have to keep in mind, this is an evolved spiritual successor to one of the greatest PC franchises of all time, System Shock.
Oh, System Shock is so fucking scary. Like,
it's terrifying.
I mean, BioShock is atmospheric and it's tense, and there's points where you don't really want to do anything at all in it, you know, but oh, System Shock, even now, it's such a scary game. It's perfect. So good.
Yeah. Atlas, Frank Fontaine, and Andrew Ryan are not a millionth as terrifying as Shodan was capable of being at her worst. No. It's not even remotely close. No Splicer, no Big Daddy, no Songbird or Iron Patriot that you come across in any of these three games even comes close to Shodan.
No.
But this really does it in a very different way. Everything is laid out so immaculately to create a sense of constant dread and being frequently outgunned. In some sense. Less so in Bioshock 2, I think, which I consider superb, but still the least of the three games. But in the first game especially, you have a narrative that covers so much ground and then completely pivots on what I think is easily the best executed twist of just about any video game I've ever played.
Yeah.
In terms of something coming absolutely out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And turning everything you think you've known for the past however many hours on its head.
Well, see, with that, just to interrupt quickly, I recently replayed the Bioshock trilogy on the collection, the remastered collection for Xbox One. And having already completed all of them at least twice, like Bioshock 1 and 3 I've played through 3 times, 2 I've played through twice, and then I played through them all again on this collection. The first Bioshock, more than any of the others, you know, there's parts in it where I'm trying to remember the exact point in this game, but you have to go to the bathysphere because Andrew Ryan has told you, you've been told that the family, I believe, is in the bathysphere.
Atlas's family.
I gave away the entire plot there, basically. So if you've not played Bioshock at this point and I ruined it for you, one, I'm sorry, but two, what the fuck are you doing listening to podcasts if you've not played Bioshock anyway? At that point, you know, I'm defending this bathysphere, hoping that the outcome is going to be different, and that's something that the best movies only do. You know, you watch, there's a certain few movies that I would say, like when you watch The Usual Suspects, for example, just first thing that comes out of my mind, The Usual Suspects. You kind of hope that one time you watch it, it's not going to be Kaiser Soze. And that's exactly how I felt playing this through for the fourth time. The fourth time! And I wasn't even 50% through the storyline, and I was hoping that things would go differently.
Oh, God. I was that way when I played the first season of Telltale's The Walking Dead. And you'll have to forgive me. I don't have the best memory sometimes when it comes to character names. The one wherein you're basically keeping her hostage in the camper while you and Kenny are trying to decide exactly what to do with her at one point.
And then
you go in the camper to check on her. And I keep trying to find some way to keep her from charging off with the damn camper. I played that like four times. At least four times, maybe even five or six, trying to figure out, okay, is there some other way I can navigate this dialogue tree? Some other way I can keep her from taking the camper and sticking around? Because, God, I didn't want to leave her to the walkers, but at the same time, I wanted to give her a chance. I wanted to redeem her in some way.
Yeah. Although if someone steals your camper, then they can be eaten. To be honest, as an owner of a camper van, if someone stole that from me, I'd want them dead, and I'd want them dead ugly.
but you get the idea, though. It's those moments where you dread that part. It's like, again, another spoiler warning here. Thane's death in Mass Effect 3. You just, there's no way you want to experience that all over again. There are people that I'm sure probably still, to this day, shed a tear when Aerith dies in Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah.
Just when it's done so right like that. It stands up to replay after replay.
Yeah.
And then BioShock actually has a few moments like that. Not really sad moments, I would say.
Poignant.
But yeah, there's certainly some that are poignant, but in my opinion, it's the scares that really get me. My two favorites are the first time you get one of the plasmids. I want to say it's I think Incinerate, maybe, right. Or it's I forget which one it is. But you turn around and there's a splicer right fucking there.
See, I remember that bit from the bees when you get the bees when you get swarm. And you're in the sort of the honey factory kind of bit, and you've been sent there kind of innocently almost, and all of a sudden there's a fucking splicer in a full on beekeeper outfit.
Oh God, yes. There's the one where you're traipsing about inside the mortuary, and the lights are flickering.
Oh geez, yeah.
And you can see a shadow running around. The first time took me far longer than it probably should have to finish that, because I was moving super slowly, just a few steps at a time, with my finger just having the trigger about like a third press down, ready to fire something off the instant I saw something solid move into my crosshairs. There's the part in Hephaistus Station. Sometimes you'll walk into a room, there'll be dead splicers on the ground, the lights will go down for a second, they'll come back up, and all of a sudden they'll be on their feet, ready to tear the atom out of you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I mean, that's the thing. I categorically hate jump scares in games. I absolutely despise them. And that's one of the reasons that I don't necessarily play a lot of horror games, because they rely so handily on the sort of jump scare factor. And when I'm playing games, I'm either kind of doing something else at the same time, like I've got music on, or I'm kind of talking to someone or writing while picking up a pad and just going back and forward. Like right now, I quite honestly, full on disclosure here, I am sitting looking at a conversation screen on Mass Effect Andromeda, tidying up a few of the sort of relationship missions. And I've sat with that for the last 20 minutes because I do other things. But that's the problem, is that certain games like Resident Evil 7, which I have played, kind of rely so heavily on that. But the thing with BioShock is that it's such a scary game, but to put your comparison, you mentioned movies earlier on, and saying that there was so many different things you had to take into account when really reviewing or comparing one movie to another. And to compare BioShock to something else, I would say that BioShock is the Exorcist of horror games, and that if you watch The Exorcist, it's not a terrifying movie, and there are movies since that have made things that it does seem very irrelevant and not at all shocking. But at its core, and I say this somewhat, I along with Evil Dead 2, I think The Exorcist is the best horror movie ever made.
It's hard to refute that argument.
The two of them are very different movies, but The Exorcist is so good because it doesn't go for jump scares. It doesn't try and trick you into being frightened like some shitty movies do when you know fine that someone's going to jump out of the cupboard and oh very scary, blah blah blah. The Exorcist, still to this point, it attacks something more than just your five senses.
Well, what I think it does is The Exorcist is to horror movies what I think to a certain extent Bret Hart is to professional wrestling. And that is, it's a movie that's easy to lose yourself and kind of invest yourself in, because it's one of those that... Hey, I got a sneeze.
We are live.
Well, I thought I had to sneeze. it's one of those that you invest yourself in because somehow it doesn't feel exactly like it's entirely removed from reality. Like somehow it could still be real. And maybe it's because there's so many stories of actual exorcisms, and it parallels so many of them so closely. And maybe that's a big part of it, or maybe it's just that it happens to kind of touch some little hidden place inside of everybody, not in like the show us on the doll way, but in a way that you just never expect something to, and kind of leaves you a little bit unnerved.
Yeah.
For what it kind of toys with. But I'm glad you put that in kind of the horror context, because allow me to kind of throw back at you a franchise that has put out, in my opinion, two virtually perfect games. And I'll say two only because I haven't played the most recent one yet. Just throwing that out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that Resident Evil has actually produced two nearly perfect survival horror games. Obviously there's Resident Evil 4.
Yeah.
Come at me and fight me, bro, on that one if you want to dispute that. It's a nearly perfect game.
Yeah, can't disagree with that.
But the really surprising part is the other one is actually the remake of the first game, and not the original release of Hideki Kamiya's, I think it was Hideki Kamiya that made the first Resident Evil.
Yes, it was.
I think it was. Okay, yeah. I've normally got a damn near eidetic memory, but I sometimes get the developers kind of mixed up sometimes. Kamiya did a damn fine job on Resident Evil, but then the really amazing thing was, after a couple sequels and several moments that didn't really live up to quite what Capcom and I think he would have liked, he went away for a minute and came right back and said, "Oh, ho, that's cute. Let me show you how Daddy do it."
Yeah.
And it's one of those rare times where somebody remakes anything and it just far and away exceeds the original. Yeah. So much so that it's almost comical to compare them.
Yeah, I mean, the my problem with the sort of earlier Resident Evils is the control scheme. I find it still kind of abrasive. Like, I didn't play them at the time because I knew that it wasn't the sort of thing I was into then. I'm still no good at stealth. I'm not really good at resource management in games. So I kind of like the sort of games where you can have...
Which is astounding, considering you're such a big Fallout fan.
Well, this is the thing, is that I know, I mean, Fallout kind of falls in its own category. I seem to do better at Fallout and anything else. Like, I almost treat that more like just life. You know, if I want to buy this thing, I need to...
That's a good way to put it, especially if you're playing 3 or New Vegas. I mean, to kind of insert a little personal importance here, Fallout 3, when I was kind of recovering from the lowest point of depression that I've dealt with for years, that was what really helped me kind of relearn how to organize myself.
Yeah, I think that aspect of Fallout is so underappreciated by society. Like, my girlfriend kind of got into Fallout 4 a little while ago. She's given up on it since, so don't ask about progress or anything. And the one thing that she couldn't really get into was like the trading system, because it is so important, especially if you're playing a sort of harder difficulty. On it is that you need to really manage your resources and you need to sell ammo for guns you're not using and stuff. And she couldn't really get her head around it. But for me, that it's the most carnal version of money management I've ever dealt with. And quite honestly, it helps me on a day-to-day basis. Like, especially right now, because I'm currently sort of between jobs, I can hedge my bets on FPG News a little bit. Not that I expected it to make me money or anything, but I kind of made a slight miscalculation. So right now, if I want to buy something, I need to figure out what that something is worth.
Yep.
So, yep. Fallout kind of taught me that. And it sounds pathetic to admit, but, you know, everyone needs to work out how they're paying their bills in one way or another. And some people are right. up to their tits in debt. I mean, full disclosure, I'm nearly 33 years old. I own my own home, but also I'm currently unemployed. And there has been occasions where I've not been so sensible with money, and I've been in debt, and I've been worrying about where my next meal is coming from. And right now, the only way that I can compare my real life to a video game is the Fallout trading system, because I know that if I want to get X amount of money, I have to do two or three different quests / real life tasks. Or I can trade a couple of things that I have to get a tank of petrol, or to get something that I want, like Mass Effect Andromeda.
It teaches you to be outcome-oriented in terms of how you lay out your plan and how you choose to go about things. Because so many times, especially in Fallout 3, especially if you're approaching that game from multiple playthroughs and kind of knowing what the sequence of things is, you gain a sense of, okay, I have to do for the best possible outcome to make things easy for myself going forward. I have to do these things in this order, and this is why, and this is what I'm going to get as kind of the positive outcome of each step.
Yeah.
I'm going to get this, which is going to benefit me, in that way. You learn to look at things and really size up, okay, what is its utility going to be?
Yeah.
And that's why it teaches you to kind of manage money carefully. Because I'm in the same boat, and that to me is one of the beauties of video games, is especially if you're somebody who has been dealing with mental illness. It's something that – and I had this moment a number of times with several games that really helped me reach a turning point. You look at this and realize, you know, what I'm doing here isn't that different from what I need to do to just be a better adult. If I can do it here and do it this well, who's to say that I can't parlay this into doing something else and be equally as successful? You realize, especially if you're playing a modern ARPG, just how close it is to the way a normal person would actually think.
Yeah.
And it's really striking that way. But getting back to Resident Evil, though, in a way, that's the same way, because in a way, that's also resource management. Okay, you have a sense of scarcity, which means you got to kind of ration things out a little bit, and you got to make things last until you can get to that next room and see what's there. But that's admittedly looking at it a little more deeply than some people would. Overall, though, the first game is. It's you, stupid cockwomble. What the hell are you doing? You fucking weapon. you bald A-train looking bastard. It's amazing how many Scottish insults I've started just weaving into random conversation since I started talking to you regularly. Also, hi Cara and Nelly, how you doing? but in terms of the first game, we'll start with that one. You have a game that really turned horror on its head by almost making desperation a game mechanic.
Yeah.
And a real kind of almost pervasive character in and of itself. It was far-fetched and full of lots of ridiculous twists, and the original had that famously awful voice acting, and yeah, the fixed camera and the tank controls, but the fixed camera I liked.
See, just as a quick aside on the voice acting. Now, just really randomly, if you have a PS1 and if you have a copy of the original Resident Evil, go to your PS1 without a disc in it, go into your MP3 manager and turn the pitch right up. Turn it right up as full as it goes and then play Resident Evil because it plays everything at that pitch. And it is fucking delightful. So you suddenly have a conversation where you have Claire walking in. Oh my god, that looks like blood. Yes. But what is it? Is it blood? Yes, it's blood. Oh my god, blood. That conversation goes from being gouge your fucking eyes out agony to being one of the best things you'll ever hear in your entire life.
So, I'm now trying to imagine you were almost a Jill sandwich. and you say it's really pitched up?
Oh, it's immense. Like, that was the original delivery. So it's like, what is it? Blood. Oh, it looks like blood. Yes, it's blood.
It's, you were almost a Jill sandwich.
This is wonderful. Honestly, there's a few games on the PS1 that this actually works for. It's same if the Sega Saturn had the same sort of feature. If you have the original hardware, I beg you to go and do it because it is the best experience you'll ever have with a video game. So
that is some broken brilliance right there.
Yeah, yeah,
but if you put that aside. The first one, what I loved about it was what the fixed camera did was it kind of drove home, you are not in control here.
Yeah.
You are really kind of at the game's mercy in terms of what you can see, what you and how you can respond to things. Was it frustrating to proceed from one screen to the next and then have the fucked up tank controls all of a sudden send you, for whatever reason, walking back into the other screen because the other one happened to have kind of a reverse perspective? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But what the remake did was it added better storytelling, obviously improved voice acting. It took the visuals to a whole nother level with the polish of the Nintendo GameCube, which, in my opinion, deserves to go down alongside the Sega Saturn as one of the most underappreciated consoles in video game history.
Yeah.
It already took a classic that literally defined a genre. I mean, there was no such thing. I mean, unless you want to count Resident Evil's original inspiration, Sweet Home, there was nothing like Resident Evil before Resident Evil.
Yeah.
It was, put it this way, it was the game that set the bar for Silent Hill. And for Konami and Capcom to kind of go back and forth with their franchises, seemingly kind of one-upping each other in their own way. But to do that was one thing. I mean, it's one thing to go back and take your own creation and remake it and show that even you can do any better. What, in my opinion, really makes Kamiya one of the greatest developers of all time was then years later, when the franchise was starting to stagnate and had taken a couple missteps, he then decided to take everything he had created, blow it up, redefine it as pretty much an entirely different kind of game in a completely new setting on a whole new console generation. And god damn it, it was a classic again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, of course, is Resident Evil 4.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, granted, it didn't have that kind of element of desperate scarcity, of not being able to find ammo, being constantly overwhelmed. It didn't even really have zombies in a proper sense. But it was in equal turns. It was action packed. It was tense. It's how funny that game is always goes so vastly underappreciated. Visually, it was excellent. It controlled beautifully as now an over-the-shoulder third-person shooter.
Yeah.
And again, this is all developed by the same guy. The same guy did all of this. And it's like watching a Nightmare on Elm Street movie that's directed by Wes Craven and then watching a Nightmare on Elm Street movie that's directed by absolutely anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing I would say is that actually I really enjoyed Resident Evil 5. I
think 5 gets the respect it deserves sometimes. It's a very good but not great game, but it really gets shat upon to Resident Evil 6 degrees by some people, and that's not right.
Resident Evil 5 is actually the only one of them that I've ever finished. Genuinely, at Resident Evil 5, the only Resident Evil game I've completed. So, yeah. I enjoy it. I played it co-op, so maybe that had something to do with it, and I actually had like a fun experience with a friend. But yeah, I thought it was great. I recently restarted it on Xbox One, and I'm looking forward to the ride, actually. Sue me. Fight me.
if we're talking about kind of perfect games, here's one that's kind of outside of franchise in that it's an immaculate game that I can't believe. And when you know the reason, it becomes kind of understandable, but it's still hard to imagine it never got a follow-up. Did you ever play Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem?
So good. So good.
Jesus!
It's such, this is going way, way back. Way, way back now. For those of you who, and I don't think there's many, who've followed me for a little while, you will know that I used to write for 411 Mania. And if you track me through there, I wrote for the MMA Zone and then started getting into a little bit of the game side of things and dipping my toe in wrestling from time to time. But eventually I took over the Retronomicon on 411. And one Halloween, I decided to do a history of horror games. And I started off talking about like Haunted House on the Atari, which in the very stripped back way that it handles itself and was only ever capable of, it's Resident Evil on a Flash player. Like it's such a good horror game, such an understated horror game. But I also took the time to replay a few other games, and one of them was Eternal Darkness. The way that this game twists and turns, and it throws back to what I was saying about Bioshock, in that it wasn't reliant on jump scares. It was reliant on taking your comfort zone from you and just telling you everything that you knew about what you were expecting was wrong. And it's perfect. And do you know what? Thank you for bringing it up, because certainly as far as horror games go, I would say it's probably the best there's ever been in terms of what a horror game should actually be.
There are a lot of people who would agree with you, and it has the total package. It has incredible for its design, sound design. It was far ahead of its time. It takes this Lovecraftian horror story and paces it out and spans a number of historical eras and gives each one, while kind of all keeping it entwined kind of into the mythos and the aesthetic of the same game, and gives it its own personality. In many cases, their own unique mechanics as you're playing this anthology of different characters. it has the sanity mechanic.
Yeah.
Takes on so many, it's tweaked so many different ways, even depending on the character that you're playing.
Yeah.
And that character's personality and that level of mental constitution as they're individually defined. And it finds so many ways to screw with you that both make you – they make you tense. They make you laugh sometimes because you genuinely don't know sometimes if what you're playing is a glitch with the game or if it's the game actively intentionally screwing with you. And it's so unfortunate that Silicon Knights was a business disaster.
Yeah.
As a developer. Because, man, that just makes you think so hard about what could have been. But, you know, that was a game that was pretty much flawless from the get-go. You know what really amazes me, though, Stu? It's when you have a game that's flawed from the start, from its first game. And then we'll kind of like Mass Effect 2. The developer goes back and really listens to the fan input and says, okay, this was good. What do we have to do to make it great? And then the follow-up comes out and you realize they hit every base. They left no stone unturned. That is what makes, in my opinion, Assassin's Creed 2 a damn near flawless game. There's no other way to describe it. I've played it a handful of times, and I just can't find anything patently wrong with it.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean that is what separates the perfect games from any other game. It's that there's nothing wrong with it. But you know what? There's something about flaws sometimes, and there's something about bugs, and there's something about little glitches, and that's why I love Bethesda games. That's why I love Fallout. I know that Fallout's not perfect. I know it's bugged to hell. I know there's plot devices involved that just make absolutely no sense. Fox, I am looking directly at your stupid super mutant face right now. You could have gone into that fucking purifier, you big green dick, but you didn't, so I died. And I'm now okay with that. You know, it's taken me nearly 10 years. But I'm okay with that, Fox, you fucking asshole. But just before we end this podcast, in terms of games you've played sort of recently, you know, the last few years, I'm going to ask you about something that you would say to people they should check, because in terms of what it is, it's perfect. And I'm going to go first to give you a bit of extra thinking time, but I am going to put it out there that if you are into driving games, if you're into Rally Championship, Dirt Rally is the best driving game I've played for a long, long time. And I'm including Forza Horizon 3 in that. And that did rate higher in my game of the year on FPG News, because ultimately it's probably the more full game. But if you want to get involved in the sort of rally racing kind of things, Dirt Rally is the Dark Souls of driving games. It's unforgiving. It looks absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
In terms of what it should be, it absolutely is that. So that's what I'm going to go with. Sean, I don't know if that's given you enough time. I don't know if I've stalled enough talking about my love for Dirt Rally.
I could toss a couple of recommendations out there. First off, if ever you have the chance, it's hard to find, hard to track down, but if you truly want to play a perfect top-to-bottom game that just touches all the bases, track down the PC version of Batman Arkham Knight. I'm kidding. Stop. Step away from Steam right now. Don't do that. Kidding. Kidding.
Even just as an aside, even not being a PC user, Arkham Knight is by fucking far, glitches aside, it's by far the worst of the Arkham games. Arkham Origins got up in the morning needing a shit and not really knowing why, and that was Arkham Knight. And it was like, do you know, sometimes you get up in the morning, you need a shit, and you're like, well, what did I eat that was so bad for me that I need a shit now? You know, it's not a normal morning dump, it's more urgent than that. That's what Arkham Origins had when Arkham Knight was created. It's that fucking bad. I hate that game, I fucking hate it. I could have another podcast shit-talking Arkham Knight. Do you know what? Spoiler alert, okay? When the Batmobile finally fucking blows up, I cheered. I fucking cheered. Honestly, it's the first time in my entire gaming life that I got off my sofa and cheered at what was happening on my screen, because I was so relieved to see the end of those dog shit fucking segments. And then what happened? You had fake Morgan Freeman coming over the Batcom going, "It's okay, Bruce. I've got another one." Fuck off! Fuck off! I don't want another fucking Batmobile, you stupid cunt! Send it back! Send it back! I don't want to play another fucking tank mission. I want to float around, I want to press my left fucking bumper so I can grapple hook on a chimney sweep, and I want to take out some fucking bad guys. I don't want to drive around in your stupid shithouse, you dick.
What were you saying? One day I need to start a Let's Play or a streaming channel.
So you're recommending good games, Sean. You're recommending good games that people should check out.
Okay. Games I would recommend that I played the last few years. And again, I would preface, I have not had a chance to play much of anything on the PS4. Money being what it is, it's one of my things I'm going to be upgrading to very soon. But of what I have played, I would, for one thing, I would throw out the Tomb Raider remake, and from what I understand, from what our good friend Nelly tells me, Rise of the Tomb Raider. That is rebooting a franchise done absolutely, wholly, perfectly right. Again, I realize, that's not new. How are you just getting around to that? Look, I spent a lot of time, once I finally kind of had my head straight, digging into a lot of stuff that I hadn't had a chance to because I wasn't really sound enough to kind of enjoy it. Hell, I only just played Bayonetta for the first time back in 2016.
Beautiful game. Beautiful.
Oh God, I love that game. Yeah.
That's another one, actually. That is a fucking perfect game. And if you have the ability to play it, please do so, because it is perfect.
Play it and then prepare to hate Nintendo for the fact that they got exclusivity rights to the sequel, because for some goddamn reason nobody else was smart enough to back it.
Yeah.
So yeah, guess what, guys? We're never getting to play Bayonetta 2, more than likely. Womp womp! I would also throw in The Last of Us. I would throw in BioShock Infinite. Yeah. The Last of Us, by the way, do not play without a metric fuck ton of tissue around. That is a life changing game right there.
I'm going to put it out there that actually I didn't like it.
Really?
Yep. I made it about 20% through the storyline, and the gameplay was not my kind of game. So
it doesn't reinvent the wheel in terms of gameplay, but I like the fact that there are a number of ways you can play it successfully. You aren't limited to either just going in guns blazing or just having to sneak your way through every section. I felt it was pretty balanced in that regard. But to throw out a couple other ones, though, that I think are really worth a look. For those of you out there who are really kind of put off by the modern look and feel of gaming, especially AAA games, Undertale. Look it up and play the hell out of it. It is a 8 or 16-bit style RPG. A very kind of self-referential and often tongue-in-cheek one, but also a very kind of sensitive and really touching one that's very openly inspired by Earthbound. It was a lot of people's game of the year last year, and totally rightfully so. If you don't feel like playing it, I can tell you that one of my favorite YouTubers, Dodger, has got a uploaded in episodes her full playthrough of it from her stream to her YouTube channel. Press Heart to continue. It's absolutely worth it because the game has no voice acting, but as she's wont to do with a lot of what she plays, she chooses to voice all the characters herself instead, which I cannot begin to describe how entertaining that always is. Bless her little heart. There are some other good ones that I would recommend. The remake of Doom was shockingly good. You mentioned Bethesda; they knocked that one out of the park, and it was about as glitch-free as I think any Bethesda game is ever going to get. Just extremely, extremely clean. I'm not going to go on raving about Mass Effect 2 because I want to spare you all having to hear that. That's practically a podcast unto itself, and also that's a fairly old game. But as newer stuff goes, that's most of what I can think of. But what I would kind of recommend is don't be afraid to get outside of your comfort zone. And don't be afraid to really look outside of the AAA marketplace, because there are a lot of indie devs out there. Granted, Steam can be a cesspool at times, but every so often you find an ambitious indie developer who puts something together that ends up really changing the face of gaming. I think anybody who's ever played Five Nights at Freddy's will tell you that. But you know, just get out and by all means, for God's sake, play something besides Call of Duty. Just momentarily recognize that Call of Duty will have another game within the next 12 months. There will be another probably two or three Mario games within the next 12 months. You know, there will be another disappointing Halo sequel in all possibility within the next couple years. Madden will still be there. Just go broaden your horizons and just kind of look for that game that looks a little bit different, doesn't look like anything you've ever played before. And if the price is right, give it a go. Just give it a try, because when Scarlett first talked me into playing Mass Effect 2, I had never played anything like it before. I wasn't that big on space as a setting. I had never played the only ARPG I had played was Kingdom Hearts, if that gives you some idea. I wasn't even really all that into shooters. But by the end of it, I was so thoroughly invested, I couldn't wait to start a new playthrough. When I played Bayonetta for the first time, I had no idea. I didn't even know really what type of game it was. But so help me God, that is the most absurd opening tutorial section you will ever play in any game, on any system, in any console. And if that doesn't hook you with just how goddamn much fun it is playing an eight foot tall, sexy Umbra Witch who is blowing the heads off of angels to a dance remix of Fly Me to the Moon, I just can't begin to fathom your definition of fun, because it doesn't resemble mine.
Exactly. And that's the thing. With games, you got to be having fun. And I had a ton of fun with the new Mass Effect. I thought it was really good fun. And it's a perfect way to round off the podcast and round off the show. And I know it's gone a little bit longer this week, but I like to think it's been worth it. So, Sean, I thank you for coming on very late notice. We didn't get as many guest characters as I was hoping for, but it was still good. It's still good. Hearing your voice is its own reward, but the extra wee bits that you sometimes add are even better.
I always look forward anytime I have some room on my schedule to do a podcast with you. That was why when you said, "Can you do a show in 30 minutes?" Oh, hell yeah, I can. Even kept you on while I was going through the drive-thru and getting my Whataburger.
Excellent. Well, Sean, if you've got anything you want to say to everyone before we go off, then go for it.
I'm just going to say, Brother Rattlitch, delete cancer, sir. Send a good thought to our buddy, our fearless leader, our mandated reporter, Mark Rattlitch. His treatment for cancer has begun on a bit of a rocky note. He's spent the last couple days in good spirits, but not in the best of health. Cancer absolutely sucks. It is the polar opposite of Batman.
Yeah.
But you know, I've seen few face it more bravely than he has. So send a thought his way, and otherwise, thank you everybody for listening to us. Keep tuning in, keep clicking, keep recommending us to friends. And in the meantime, as always, two last things. Number one, remember that $20 will buy many peanuts. And number two, never dull your colors for someone else's canvas.
Perfect. Thanks for the ending, Sean. I can't think of anything to say to follow up any of that. Mark, we love you, guy. And yeah, everyone else, I'll see you next week for another Press Start podcast. Peace out, guys.